Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
6 months after Hurricane Michael, the glacial pace of recovery has residents of the devastated panhandle seething.
With the exception of the other area counties, we are meeting our challenges alone. It almost seems like somehow we caused the storm ourselves.
Also tonight, Sarasota Senator Joe Gruters has a bill aimed at reducing the cost and time of recovery after hurricanes.
What this Harding project will hopefully do is not only get our state back to work immediately, but it will hopefully reduce the cost of those post-storm recovery efforts and hopefully we'll slash them.
We'll also learn why advocates of a higher minimum wage in Florida aren't giving up on what might be a futile fight, and we'll discover what Florida University will soon be majoring in marijuana research. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to week number 7 in the 9-week Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Panhandle leaders are growing frustrated at the slow pace of recovery from Hurricane Michael. They say residents of the storm-battered region are becoming disenchanted, both from inaction at the federal level and now from the state. And as Lynn Hatter reports, they're calling for someone, anyone, to step in.
When Hurricane Harvey struck Texas, the American Red Cross reported it raised more than $500 million toward relief efforts. When Hurricane Irma struck Florida that same year, the Disaster Relief Agency reported raising nearly $100 million. The number fell to $64 million for Hurricane Florence and stands at only $35 million for Hurricane Michael. Bay County officials say they feel abandoned.
Today's issue we face in isolation. With the exception of the other area counties, we are meeting our challenges alone. It almost seems like somehow we caused the storm ourselves.
It's been 6 months since Michael devastated North Florida and South Georgia, and residents are still waiting on Congress to pass some sort of federal aid package. Bay County School Superintendent Bill Hussfeld notes other states did not have to wait as long.
In 2016, President Trump signed a bill from Congress for Hurricane Harvey relief for $22 billion. That was within 2 weeks after Hurricane Harvey. In January of 2013, almost 2 months after Hurricane Sandy devastated part of the East Coast, Congress appropriated $50 billion for Hurricane Sandy relief, and President Obama signed that. That's huge. 2 months on one and 2 weeks on the other.
A $14 billion relief package for Hurricane Michael remains stalled in Congress. President Donald Trump is opposed to language in it that provides additional relief to Puerto Rico. But in most places, the situation looks exactly as it did a day after Hurricane Michael. That's because entire cities were leveled, and so were 72 million tons of trees in an area the size of Connecticut and Delaware combined. Those trees are now becoming a fire hazard, says State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Freed.
If conditions are right, those fallen trees are a disaster waiting to happen, the likes of which this state has not seen in decades.
A recent wildfire that should have been put out within hours ended up scorching some 700 acres and took days to contain because fallen trees made the area hard to get to.
Imagine every single building, every man-made and God-made structure in your city was damaged or destroyed, absolutely everything. When the wind stopped, security systems were sounding, car alarms were blaring, Water was spraying where trees and power poles were uprooted. People were screaming, looking for their families and homes crushed by trees.
Recovery in North Florida could take a decade or longer, but Panama City Republican Representative Jay Trumbull recently told his House colleagues the region doesn't have that long. People have moved. Businesses and homes are being demolished. Workers are leaving, and the daily items that make up individual lives are being carted off in dump trucks.
You know, our people aren't beggars, and we don't live off of handouts. Our people hand out. Our people give out.
But Trumbull says the well of local government has run dry. The state of Florida is on track to spend $1.8 billion on recovery efforts. Half of that is reimbursable from the federal government. Trumbull and others are worried about budget negotiations for the upcoming fiscal year. The Senate is pitching $220 million worth of projects. The House has included $190 million for such efforts. Bay County School Board Chairman Steve Moss says he's starting to believe the North Florida slight is intentional.
I get frustrated because I honestly think if we lived in Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach County, I think we'd have the funds that we need, honestly. But we're not. We're in a relatively rural part of the state, and maybe not as affluent as some of those communities. But if you look at the track record of some of those communities that have had similar type hurricanes and disasters, they've received the funding.
Meanwhile, state lawmakers are trying to get a handle on the rising costs. Bay County schools could get an extra $12 million to address a significant decrease in student enrollment. Both chambers have funding to support and reimburse state agencies, and another $500 million is coming to the region through an executive order signed by Governor Ron DeSantis. But Michael is a $25 billion disaster.
And so it blows my mind that we don't have some type of comprehensive disaster relief bill already on the governor's desk.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, recently issued reimbursements to Bay County for $18 million on a $380 million bill. That bill is rising, and counties are still submitting claims to the agency. I'm Len Hatter.
When Florida is hit by a hurricane, utility companies must go in and help recover immediately. They pay for the cost up front and later charge customers to recoup their losses. Blaise Ganey reports a Senate bill aims to lower both the price tag and time of recovery by forcing utility companies to strengthen their infrastructure before a storm.
We've had Michael, Matthew, and Irma over the last 3 years wreak havoc on our state. And Florida's done a very good job at pre-storm preparation and post-storm recovery efforts, but we can do better as a state.
That's Sarasota Republican Senator Joe Gruters. When storms like those hit, it causes utility rates to rise because of companies trying to recoup the cost they spent to rebuild the infrastructure in the impacted areas.
In the panhandle right now, there's a case in front of the Public Service Commission where Gulf Power is asking for an $8.50 per rate user increase per month as a result of the cost that it took to rebuild that network.
Gruters wants to change the way public utility companies operate by requiring them to create better transmission and distribution storm protection plans. Those plans would focus on three things.
How we can make our state more resilient, how we can make our electrical grid stronger, and how we could bring people, especially the most vulnerable among us, back and get people back to work as quickly as possible.
Gruters wants greater focus on shoring up overhead electric transmission lines, more buried lines, and more aggressive tree trimming. The state Republican Party chairman says he wants to make sure the state can get back to normal as soon as possible after storms.
What this hardening project will hopefully do is not only get our state back to work immediately, but it will hopefully reduce the cost of those post-storm recovery efforts, and hopefully we'll slash them.
Gruter's plan includes a cost recovery mechanism for burying power lines. He says it will help poor communities the most because often they're the ones who suffer most.
If you have the resources, you could escape the storm. If you have a good job, you could withstand. Me personally, both of my offices and my house go down for 6 days. A lot of people don't have the ability to deal with that. I continue to make payroll on behalf of my employees, but some people can't. If you're living paycheck to paycheck, and they say 50% of Americans can't survive not having a paycheck for one consistent month, and if you're out of work, you're out of luck.
Right now, communities typically get their lines buried by teaming up to foot the cost themselves. But Gruter says some communities can't afford it.
A lot of newer communities, there are no feeder lines going into homes. You see that. And some of these neighborhoods are the first ones with their power back up. But some of the communities that need the most help, they will never have their lines buried unless we go to this type of plan and long-range plan for the entire state, because the costs are going to be spread throughout the rate base throughout the entire state of Florida.
John Moyle with the Florida Industrial Power Users Group opposes the plan. He says the initial cost of the project is too high.
Some people have called this the $30 billion rate hike bill.
Moyle says the current process is best because it charges the people who would benefit directly from the service.
Some people, Senator Mofford, you have a lot of constituents in counties, they would say, well, if the city of Pensacola or Seaside wants to underground, that's on them. We shouldn't have people living in counties subsidizing the cities.
But Gruter says this helps everybody, not just the city that gets worked on first.
At the end of the day, we're all interconnected, all of us. It doesn't matter where you are with the state, rich or poor area. If a third of our state goes down, it's $1 billion a day.
In Miami Gardens, Democratic Senator Oscar Brainin agrees. He represents both impoverished and wealthy areas and thinks Gruter's plan is fair.
Now, there are other ways, other options, but this is one that I think he said where everyone pays to harden our entire system. And to me, that makes sense, and that's the only fair way I'm ever going to get hardening, whether it be undergrounding, whether it be stronger poles. I'll ever get that in some of my lower income areas. And so that's a matter of fairness, and for me, that's why I support the bill.
The Senate bill is headed to the floor after passing each of its three committees unanimously. The House bill is waiting to be scheduled for its third committee hearing and so far hasn't received a down vote. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Governor DeSantis wants to protect speech on college campuses.
In an academic institution where you have a speaker expressing ideas, there's no room for a heckler's veto where you simply shout down and scream down a speaker.
After so many years of ramping up penalties for various crimes, Florida lawmakers now seem eager to reverse that trend, although that goal appears easier said than done. Meanwhile, chances of passage this session are next to nil, but that hasn't stopped advocates for pushing a higher minimum wage statewide.
I have to decipher, do I feed my children, do I feed myself, do I pay my bills, and it's not enough.
And as Florida's legislature continues its struggle to implement the state's medical marijuana amendment, Florida A&M University will help provide the hard facts and figures to make that process more scientific.
We're going to have multiple research initiatives, programs, projects, call it what you will, going on at the same time.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Governor Ron DeSantis says he wants the state's colleges and universities to do more to protect free speech on campus. He's touting a move by all 12 state university presidents to adopt a resolution DeSantis says champions free speech. Regan McCarthy has more.
Governor Ron DeSantis says he doesn't think speech should be limited to free speech zones or banned from so-called safe spaces.
The role of the university is not to shield students from speech that make them uncomfortable. The cure for speech that one disagrees with lies not in prescription, but in open debate and free inquiry.
Lawmakers passed the Campus Free Expression Act last year to ban free speech zones. DeSantis says it should be the role of universities to ensure voices on any side of an issue have the ability to be heard.
In an academic institution where you have a speaker expressing ideas, there's no room for a heckler's veto where you simply shout down and scream down a speaker so that they cannot articulate views.
The state's universities have signed a resolution modeled after the Chicago Statement, a free speech policy created by the University of Chicago in 2014. It includes language that prohibits students from obstructing or interfering with the freedom of others and calls on universities to protect a person's free speech when others try to restrict it. In 2017, protesters at the University of Florida shouted down a speech by white nationalist Richard Spencer, forcing him to leave his speech early. But DeSantis says there's a better way to handle that.
That is somebody who's trying to stoke division. And I think some of these people, the biggest antidote you can do is if they give a speech and only eight people show up, that is really the worst, because they really feed off trying to gin people up. And so, I would tell people, you have someone like that. I mean, I was like, you know, just an empty auditorium would be the best response that you can give to that. And when that happens, then what do? Because they don't know what the heck to do from there.
Florida Education Commissioner and House Speaker Richard Corcoran says it's becoming increasingly important to protect free speech and expose students to new viewpoints.
It wasn't long ago, I remember watching, I think in the last year at one of our esteemed universities, a reporter went onto the campus, and in literally 1 hour, almost one a minute, he got these highly educated students to sign a petition to eliminate free speech from the Constitution by simply saying, as the governor and President Thrasher said, that isn't it wrong that someone says something to you that hurts your feelings, or isn't it wrong that somebody could argue with you and maybe cause some insecurities in students? And they're like, yeah, that's wrong. And they go, well, we should do away with the First Amendment and free speech. And they all signed.
Florida State University President John Thrasher says freedom of speech is central to the mission of universities.
Clark Kerr, the former president of the University of California system, put it this way. The university is not engaged in making ideas safe for students. It's engaged in making students safe for ideas. Thus, it permits the freest expression of views before students, trusting to their good sense in passing judgment on those views. Only in this way can we best serve American democracy.
DeSantis is asking colleges and universities to display their free speech resolutions throughout campus. Meanwhile, lawmakers are considering legislation this session that would direct state universities to conduct a survey on viewpoint diversity at each campus. I'm Regan McCarthy.
The House Appropriations Committee is set to hear an omnibus criminal justice reform bill Tuesday that, among other changes, looks to increase the threshold for felony theft offenses. Ryan Daly reports the measure also makes a significant change to who can be sentenced as a prison release reoffender.
Under the bill, the threshold warranting a felony theft offense would be raised from $300 to $1,000, which has some criminal justice reform advocates in support of the bill. It also shortens, in some cases, the length of time driver's licenses can be taken away after an offense. For instance, it would cut in half the year-long license revocation for certain adult drug offenses. But one piece of the measure would make more people eligible for mandatory minimum sentencing, something reform advocates are historically against. Matthew Hasbrook with the State Office of Economic and Demographic Research sits on the Criminal Justice Impact Conference.
This amends 775.082, expanding the pool of offenders eligible for a mandatory minimum sentence for a prison releasee reoffender by adding that they committed one of a list of offenses within 3 years after being released from a county detention facility following incarceration for an offense for which the sentence pronounced was a prison sentence.
Prison releasee offenders under Florida's law get an automatic mandatory minimum sentence. As it stands, the only formerly incarcerated people who can be sentenced based on the prison releasee offender law are those who served time in a Florida institution or one in another state. Most crimes that would qualify someone for the prison releasee reoffender status are violent and severe, carrying a lengthy sentence already. Murder, sexual battery, arson, and kidnapping are on the list. But not everyone who commits these crimes ends up in prison, as Hasbrook explains.
Potential reoffenders impacted by this language, so these were the county detention center people. In fiscal year 17-18, there were roughly 570 offenders that were sentenced to time served and released before coming to prison.
Should the bill pass, the Criminal Justice Impact Conference agreed it would grow the prison population, but could not estimate by how much. Senator Jeff Brandis, who is the principal backer of another criminal justice reform measure dubbed the Florida First Step Act, took aim at mandatory minimum sentences at a committee meeting last month.
The state has over 100 different mandatory minimums, and we catch all kinds of dolphins in that tuna net. It is just amazing to see how damaging no discretion to judges is in this process.
Another provision in the massive bill has garnered some not-so-positive buzz. A recent piece by the Orlando Sentinel editorial board calls a provision of the bill that would allow the state to automatically seal court and arrest records for those who don't get convicted a, quote, hidden cancer. I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida workers and union members are pushing for a $15 minimum wage, but Casey Chapter reports it may not be an easy feat in the state.
For low-wage workers like Lillian Hall, it's a struggle to make ends meet.
I am a single parent of four children, and it's very hard for me to live off my wages at Taco Bell. I've been there 2 years, and I'm still at $8.74.
She faces tough choices every day.
I have to decipher, do I feed my children? Do I feed myself? Do I pay my bills? And it's not enough.
Florida minimum wage workers currently earn $8.46 per hour. The group Fight for 15 wants to raise this to $15 an hour. Senator Victor Torres spoke in support of this goal.
Workers deserve to be paid a living wage, which is why we must stand and support every effort to raise the minimum wage so Floridians can afford to pay their bills, raise their families, and fulfill the dream of buying their own home.
The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association's Samantha Padgett says raising the minimum wage will cause business owners to seek out other sources of labor.
For a company to pay that much more for its labor, they're going to want that much more. Labor is a very significant cost for them. And if you make it more expensive to hire, they might look for more efficient ways to operate. Is there a robot? Is there a grill? Is there something that can be automated? Is there a computer that can do the same thing more efficiently and less expensively?
The association was recently involved in a lawsuit over a Miami Beach ordinance setting a $15 minimum wage. The Florida Supreme Court ruled the city's move violated state law, which is why folks like Torres want change.
When workers earn a fair wage, they rely on less government-funded programs and can afford to spend more money on local business. Please join us in supporting the right to increase Florida's minimum wage and help boost the income of more than 3 million, yes, 3 million of our fellow Floridians.
Washington State has raised its minimum wage to $13 per hour. A study done by University of Washington economists has shown the raise helped workers who were employed before the raise, as they saw a higher hourly rate and less of a decrease in hours. The study also found newly employed workers suffered more. Researchers suggest the raise in wages made it less worthwhile for employers to hire and train new employees. There are two bills that have been introduced in the House and the Senate that would increase the minimum wage by the rate of inflation. Neither has been heard, and the issue is likely dead for the year. I'm Casey Chapter.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, back in 2016, Florida voters approved Amendment 2, which legalized medical marijuana in the state. But in the nearly 3 years since, that legalization process has encountered many obstacles, as the Florida legislature has imposed multiple conditions and regulations. The latest took place in early April of this year. That's when the House Health and Human Services Committee adopted a 10% cap for the maximum amount of THC, marijuana's psychoactive component, for smokable medical marijuana. Dr. Cynthia Hughes-Harris with Florida A&M University's Medical Marijuana Initiative thinks the imposition of that cap by lawmakers was premature, to say the least.
That's a real good example of a research question. That situation you just described is full of unknowns. So what we have to do is change those anecdotal situations, those speculations, into fact.
Harris says those facts will soon be on the way. That's because the legislature also provided funding for FAMU to, in the words of the statute, educate minorities about marijuana for medical use and about the impact of the unlawful use of marijuana on minority communities.
There's so little that's known about medical marijuana, and what we know about the illegal use of marijuana, though it has been illegally used for quite some time, is still rather limited.
Harris says this mandate actually goes beyond simple education.
What we're doing is helping our communities understand this two-handed description of marijuana, while at the same time using formalized research and formalized community-based participation to increase our understanding.
How will that research component happen?
Well, we've implemented a process that allows faculty to apply for what we're calling grants, mini grants, to hypothesize in their realm of expertise, pharmacy, public health, allied health, criminal justice, sociology, education, law, social work, architecture, all of our academic units have applied for funding, and we are in the process of assessing those grant applications and will award funds to 5, 10, 15, 20, depending on the quality and the criteria that will have been met.
Harris explains after the initial year of research, there will be ongoing projects to acquire even more data when it comes to specific areas.
In addition to the mini grants, we're going to be establishing longer term grants that allow deeper exploration into social justice arenas, deeper exploration into health arenas, deeper exploration in arenas related to education. So we're going to have multiple research initiatives, programs, projects, call it what you will, going on at the same time.
Meanwhile, Harris asserts that Florida A&M University will quickly become one of the nation's go-to institutions when it comes to the ramifications of medical and illegal marijuana use among America's African-American population. And even though the conclusions of that research are quite a ways off, she insists there will be solid and substantive findings, such as whether or not the THC cap on smokable medical marijuana should be 10%, some other figure, or perhaps even no cap at all.
Research is going to tell us what those results are, but one thing we know, we'll have more information 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now as a result of this process than we do today.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank Casey Chapter for her contribution. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. hrflorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education. Online at myuff.org.